at screenings of Lingua Franca and different film festivals, I would hear from different either Filipino or trans or just queer, you know, aspiring filmmakers approach me that seeing me do what I do and make Lingua Franca the way I wanted to make it emboldened them and show them the possibility of doing it for themselves. I can't help feeling in a, you know, in a certain way more conscious about the potential or the power of the art that we do.
Hi, I'm Howie Severino, and I've been telling stories on TV for more than 20 years, and now on audio. Welcome to my podcast. Our guest today is a trailblazer in more ways than one. A native Cebuana and now a resident of New York, Isabel Sandoval is a filmmaking auteur and the first transgender person of color to direct and star in a film in the prestigious Venice International Film Festival. Lingua Franca is the rare film about the struggles of migrant Filipinos in the contemporary world. Isabel's film follows a transgender caregiver in New York who desperately needs a way to legalize her stay in America, as she stays in touch with her Cebuano-speaking mother in the Philippines, whom she supports. The main character falls in love with a white grandson of the elderly woman she cares for, a situation that provokes reflections on race, gender, immigration, and the Filipino experience in the diaspora. Listen in on my conversation with Isabel Sandoval.
Maayong buntag, Isabel, mula sa Quezon City. Umaga pa kasi rito eh. Anong oras na dyan sa New York?
It is, 10 p.m., 10 in the evening.
So it's a good evening as well to you, Isabel
you.
Sandoval. No? Okay, before anything else, I need to ask how you've been doing in the pandemic. Because after a shot of hope from vaccines, we're reading that there's fear of a new surge of cases in New York City.
Wow, yeah. To be honest, I've actually been thriving during the pandemic. So, hindi ko masyadong nahirapan. Since the pandemic started, I think it's because I'm an introvert. I like, you know, being alone. I like spending time with myself, being creative. So, this pandemic talaga has been quite fruitful and productive for me. I finished a new script for my next film. I'm writing a TV series. I shot two short films during the pandemic, and one of them just premiered about a month ago. It's the Miu Miu short film. So I'd like to say that the pandemic served me well, Sir Howie.
You do live in the city, right?
I actually moved. I am in New York State right now. I'm in an artist residency, but I moved out of New York City in June. I'm staying in Raleigh in North Carolina. And just liking being outside of the city. To be honest, like the last year or two in New York, I was feeling kind of anxious, you know, and there's like a tense energy. So it's nice to be in the country, so to speak.
Yeah. So, you know, we're not Americans here. We don't really know the nuances of the regions, but
yeah,
we do know that New York City is a lot more diverse. There's a lot more Asian presence. People are more used to seeing people of color in big cities. You say you're in the country, Raleigh, North Carolina. We're not familiar here with the situation in North Carolina. So in terms of reactions to you, how has it been in the South?
I have not had any problems. I mean, Raleigh is still a city, and you know, cities in the US, regardless of the region, tend to be progressive, you know, and liberal. It's really the surrounding, you know, towns, like the rural areas, that are a lot more conservative. And, you know, I mean, people mind their business where I am. So the advantage is that it's more quiet, and I like it better now.
Okay, well, you know, we arranged this interview because of your career and your achievements as a filmmaker, no? Mm-hmm. But I want to ask a couple more questions about your Asian American identity, because mm-hmm. media in the U.S. and my own social media feeds here are also full of news about violence and harassment against Asian Americans. Any thoughts about this?
Certainly, I feel that there's definitely been a considerable uptick in, you know, the instances of violence and discrimination, you know, against Asian Americans in the U.S. I mean, the most recent example of which is the massacre against the massage parlor workers in Atlanta. And, you know, there's been justifiably an uproar about, you know, how this crime is framed, whether it's just, you know, like a white guy having a bad day and suddenly feeling the urge, you know, to murder many different people who happen to be Asian. You know, I'm personally revolted by it. I've been vocal in social media about us as a community and also members of non-Asian communities to be vigilant and to be allies, that this kind of incident, one, doesn't continue to happen under our watch, and second, that these incidents, when they do happen, the perpetrators are caught and punished as they should be. I think it's also, you know, these incidents are symptoms of negative and corrosive impact on, you know, of Donald Trump's administration on America's cultural consciousness and what they consider, you know, like racism or racist behavior. And now that he's out, you know, he's already planted these seeds of bigotry and prejudice against minorities in the U.S. And now we're seeing these seeds getting cultivated and bearing fruit.
Well, you mentioned former President Trump, no? And then the political milieu in America and how it's affected the culture and the attitudes, especially towards minority and immigrant people, no? And let's go to your film, Lingua Franca, which is partly about those issues, no? Yung backdrop nga niya, I mean, you even hear the voice of Donald Trump, no? In the film. So to what extent did that political milieu and, you know, the kind of attitudes, hostile attitudes it created in America influence your decision to do this kind of film? In other words, how was the story conceived?
Yeah, you know, I've made three features so far. The first two I shot in the Philippines, Senorita en Aparicion, which is about nuns in the martial law, and Lingua Franca, which is set during the Trump administration, are very much anchored, each of them are kind of anchored in a specific socio-political setting and milieu. And it's about, my dramas tend to be about, you know, fairly private individuals who have to make a difficult choice morally in this bigger social context. And, you know, when I was starting to write Lingua Franca, I was already undergoing my gender transition at that time. But at first, it was more of a straightforward romantic drama, just, you know, this trans Filipina woman who becomes involved with a white man who isn't aware that she's transgender. But then, nung sinusulat yung script, that was when Trump became president in the U.S. And just like a lot of many minorities dito at that time, you know, we were kind of plunged into an emotional crisis, feeling scared about our situation and also feeling uncertain and vulnerable about what's going to happen. And for a time, I'd actually thought of not, you know, putting Lingua Franca aside. But then my producer, sinabi lang na, if there's a time to make this film, that time is now. And that's why I continued and finished writing the script. And that was when the final premise, yung kwento ng Lingua Franca, really came together, and and Olivia, the main character, became undocumented. And so I captured how I felt during the first 6 months of, you know, Trump's administration, and made that into the mood and tone of Lingua Franca, and that it's a romance, but it's rooted in some kind of anxiety and paranoia.
You mentioned, you started talking about the plot of your film and what it represents. When you hear Trump and you think about Trump, you know, you think about, you know, this loud presence, you know, rants, hatred, and all of this, no? And yet all of this is going on in the background. Your story unfolds in a very kind of nuanced, subtle way. You know, when my colleagues and I were discussing your film, I mean, one of the words that kept getting repeated was subtlety. I mean, much was left unsaid, no? In fact, some of the main revelations were kind of a gradual, quiet unfolding, not a big dramatic scene. I mean, I was expecting some kind of, you know, some kind of explosion sometime during the story. And I guess part of the surprise was there was no such explosion. So much of it was just seemed to be kind of a normal, you know, learning or discovery about two people's, identities and personalities. No, I guess that all of that, of course, was probably deliberate. Was there an intent to kind of normalize relationships between people who are very different from each other?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it felt that way because I was telling the story from my perspective, you know, being one Filipina immigrant, you know, trans in New York. And that's why I felt like I did not feel the need to explain, you know, my perspective or the perspective of Olivia or spoon feed everything to the audience. I believe part of me was also wanting to make sure that this film finds an intelligent and sophisticated audience. Where, because to me, you know, as a lover of film myself, the most satisfying cinematic experiences for me are the ones where you don't necessarily get a lot of information, but you're able to bring a lot of your imagination and your empathy towards the characters and their situations. And that's why it was also on purpose that given the premise of the film, sounds like a textbook social issue drama, you know, that can get preachy or, you know, loud and explosive, as you said. And by taking the opposite route, making it subtle and quiet, you know, and lyrical and sensual, I'm actually able to elicit a different emotional reaction from the audience. And that forces them, that invites them to view the character and the situation from a different light. That's how I think, you know, what art should do. It should take people to a new place emotionally and intellectually.
Yeah, of course, the gender and transgender aspect of it is just one aspect of it. No, there was a lot of Filipino representation in this movie. You don't see that often in US-made films, unless the audience is primarily Filipino, right? Pero in this case, I think you're aiming for a wider audience than just a strictly Filipino audience. So is this the kind of films that you really want to keep making?
You know, I'm evolving as a filmmaker. And, you know, I'm also very practical in the sense that I am making films within an economic system. And I want to be able to strike a balance between films that feel artistically fulfilling to me, but also make enough money commercially that I'm able to continue making the films that I want to make. So, you know, with the next project, I'm definitely scaling up in terms of budget, but I'm also going to be, you know, doing it in a style that it's more accessible to a mainstream audience, but still feels true to me. And that's the kind of balance that I want to strike with my next feature. But I definitely want to make successful films, you know, in the marketplace, but still very much my own.
Well, you know, there it is part of kind of a genre now, films about immigrant experience, which has had an appeal beyond, you know, the immigrant audience, no? And there has, in fact, been films full of Asian characters with Asian actors that have made it in the mainstream. But this particular film, of course, is Filipino, specifically Filipino. You know, you have Filipino characters speaking in Tagalog, and then there's an opportunity to even explain Filipino culture, at least to your boyfriend there in the film, right? I mean, he wanted to know about Tagalog versus Cebuano, and then you said, oh, we have so many languages.
What do they speak in the Philippines?
We have 86 languages.
How do you say man in Tagalog?
Lalaki.
Lalaki. How do you say beautiful?
Maganda.
So why would be a maganda lalaki? What?
And I notice you don't describe them as dialect. I'm glad you described them as languages, no? Cebuano is a language. It's not just a dialect, right? So I guess you... This is also an opportunity to kind of inform, educate film yeah. audiences about being Filipino.
Certainly, I think more than anything else, you know, beside it being, you know, just a dramatic film, it's an audiovisual record of our existence, you know, as a group in the fabric of American society. Like, Filipinos are there. We exist. I'm not saying with Lingua Franca that this is representative or, you know, emblem, a monolithic representation that this is the one story lang about Filipino people, but this is one of many. They're all very unique and different. You know, just because we're Filipinos doesn't mean our experience is all the same. And this film out and being part of the cultural conversation, you know, it also asserts our place in American history, I feel.
Roger Ebert described your style as quote unquote emotionally restrained. That's not usually associated with Filipino films, at least the ones made here in the Philippines, as you know. No, you know, here yeah. there's a lot of you know, crying and shouting and uh-huh. you know, fighting, etc. Do you think there's a Filipino audience for such restrained films?
You know, I mean, that's my style. If I would describe my style, I would say that it's, you know, I like to marry a film that is steeped in a socio-political setting or films that have strong political impulses and marry them with a style that's lyrical and poetic and delicate and sensual. And yeah, for me, it feels creatively fulfilling. It feels something new that's different from what's going on, not just in Philippine cinema, but also American cinema as well. And that's why I think it's striking a chord with American movie, you know, film lovers as well.
Can you tell us about this journey from Vincent to Isabel?
Yeah. So I was born and raised in Cebu. I was an only child and my mom raised me by herself. And I went to Filipino-Chinese schools from nursery. So I went to like the Ateneo de Cebu, essentially. And in college, I do not have a formal education in film. I have an undergraduate degree in psychology from the University of San Carlos.
In Cebu?
Yes, in Cebu. I was also active in student government. I was president of the student council, and I was editor-in-chief of our school paper.
Well, but may I ask, though, if you were already out then, when you were already occupied all these kind of positions?
No, I was not. And to be honest, I never really thought I might even be transgender until I got here in the U.S. And it's because, you know, in the Philippines, you know, growing up in like the late 90s, it's in my teens, like the representations of trans women are basically, I don't know, like, you're either a butt of jokes, you know, or caricature. And in school, I was really very academic oriented. I was reserved and outspoken. So I didn't identify with the image that was presented to me about what it is to be trans. And so it wasn't until after I moved here in the US and a few years after I moved here, I saw on YouTube these different professionals, you know, some of whom are working in nonprofits, some of whom are writers, and they're documenting on video their transition process. And I finally saw myself in some of these people. I realized I was asking myself the same questions. And that's what started my journey, you know, to learn if I was transgender.
So you had no inkling when you were in Cebu, or would you think it was just suppressed and because, you know, you didn't have any role models?
I mean, I have no idea. You know, there, of course, there are some like internal psychological processes that remain unconscious and inaccessible to me. But, you know, I did know that I was gay at that time. I came out to my mom when I was in, you know, the third year of college. But yeah, that was all I thought I was, that I was gay until in 2009, 2010, I started asking myself whether I was trans.
May I ask how your mother reacted?
You know, the Philippines is very Catholic. She's religious. She wasn't jumping for joy when I first told her. But, you know, that conversation that I had when it came out to her, at the end of it, she said that, you know, you're my only child. And at the end of the day, I love you. And even though I might not completely understand, you know, this process that you're going through, I want to learn and I want to support you. And, you know, that was really quite the relief and so liberating to me. A year later, I think she completely came around when she realized how transitioning suited me. I was becoming more and more successful as a filmmaker as well. Yeah.
Earlier, you described yourself, and I know that you've been describing the press that way as well. No, you were like the first trans person of color who was able to get a film shown at the Venice Film Festival. How important do you think that is for yourself and for other transgender people?
Speaking frankly, you know, at first I didn't really make that much of it. And not just, I think, being a trans filmmaker, but also being a diasporic filmmaker and, you know, a minority in a number of intersectional levels. But, you know, as the months went by and at screenings of Lingua Franca and different film festivals, I would hear from different either Filipino or trans or just queer, you know, aspiring filmmakers approach me that seeing me do what I do and make Lingua Franca the way I wanted to make it, like, emboldened them and show them the possibility of doing it for themselves as well. So I can't help feeling in a, you know, in a certain way more conscious about the potential or the power of the art that we do as minority artists to inspire others to, you know, do it their way as well.
Well, what makes this film unusual in a sense? I mean, you're not just a director here. You're like the main character. And you also edited it. Kulang na lang yata. You're also the cinematographer, no? Which you can't be if you're the actor. But
next time.
Yeah. You're planning other films. Are you going to, I don't know if you chose those, all of those roles for yourself, kasi sabi mo nga, medyo limited yung budget, now you're gonna have better budgets, I guess. Or you need that kind of involvement as a filmmaker?
Yeah, I've been thinking about that quite a lot actually in the last few months, and the way I realized it, that's just how I am as an artist. You know, I don't compartmentalize what I do in my own work. And for me, the best expression of my vision is to play these roles in my work so that I call myself an auteur. And, you know, it's really strict definition is just someone with a unique aesthetic or a style. But for me, it really, especially being a minority in the American, you know, entertainment, you know, the film industry, being an auteur acquires not just an artistic dimension, but a political one that we have control, you know, independence about how stories of our communities are told, who gets to tell it and who gets to portray it on screen. So yeah, it takes on both a political and artistic dimension for me. And that's how I am as an artist, and I've come to accept it. Like, I don't necessarily think of them as separate tasks technically, but, you know, the best way and the most satisfying way for me to express and manifest my creativity.
Well, casting yourself in the lead role probably was not very hard because, you know, it's a transgender person like you are in real life, no? But I know you're planning a new film, right? Mm-hmm. Or you're already working on a new, you said you've completed a script. I guess that's for your next film, right? I read that it's based on the Nick Joaquin short story collection, Tropical Gothic, or he also has a short story called Tropical Gothic. Is this going to be very different from what you just did?
It's going to be very different. First, it's going to be my most ambitious film. It's not necessarily, even though it's an allegory about colonialism, it's not strictly social realist. It has surreal elements, and, you know, that there's not necessarily an explicitly trans character or component to it. I don't just identify myself as a trans filmmaker, as an actor. You know, I have multiple facets, and if I'm the artist and I'm in control, and if I want to tackle a role that's not necessarily trans, but that I feel I can do justice to, you know, emotionally, in embodying the character. After all, she is still Filipina and she is my creation. You know, she came out of my imagination, and I, you know, I feel close to this character enough that I could bring her to life, I think. I'm not completely decided yet whether I'm going to act in my next feature. But I'm, you know, making myself open to the idea, especially with the success of Lingua Franca and, you know, my performance having, you know, received some acclaim, and approaching this from a logistical and pragmatic point of view as well. Like, you know, my status as a filmmaker now, you know, my profile has kind of, you know, risen in the past year, and having me in the mix, both as a director and potentially a performer, could increase its chances of getting funding abroad, especially in Europe.
Well, of course, Lingua Franca is set in contemporary times, contemporary with a lot of contemporary issues, you know, but you mentioned that Tropical Gothic is going to be more of a kind of a historical or a period piece, and then your most recent film, Shangri-La, it has some history in it as well. No, so you're obviously interested in history, but why go back to the past now at this time when there are so many other current issues you could be exploring in the contemporary society?
You know, to quote the iconic French filmmaker Claire Denis, I'm a filmmaker, I'm not a social worker. I respond to whatever, you know, kind of the ideas that come to me. I don't necessarily, like, even if I said that my stories tend to be set in a sociopolitical setting, in my creative process, it's not necessarily my conscious decision. That's just what, you know, kind of crosses my imagination and what inspires me. So for this one, I've always been fascinated in pivotal points of history. Like, for example, Aparicion was set in the months, 9 months leading to the declaration of martial law by Marcos in 1972 in Lingua Franca, Trump, you know, administration. And this one, it's set in Tropical Gothic. I mean, it's set in the first few years of the Spanish regime. You know, it's set in 1570. And it's at that time when things are really starting to change. Like, you know, it's the transition between the pre-colonial way of life and this new subjugated way of life as colonial subjects of Spain. And just that cultural shift really fascinates me as a storyteller about, you know, how people's thinking are starting to change. It interests me. But it's also, I don't want to make just a regular, predictable period movie. You know, I don't want it to feel historical. Like, I mean, it's set in its history, but I want it to feel urgent and contemporary. And that's why the main languages in this film are Cebuano or Visayan. And instead of Spanish, it's going to be in English. We're still going to be casting the Spanish actors with the Spanish characters as Spanish actors. But I want the dialogue to be in English because I don't want people to think that colonialism and imperialism are remote, antiquated, you know, themes. They continue up to today, but they're being perpetuated not by Europe, European countries, but by America, overdeveloping countries in the third world. And I want, you know, our viewers now to view it from that contemporary lens.
Well, that's really interesting. I guess that's the challenge for any filmmaker doing history. I mean, I'm interested in history myself, and it's just notable that you're deciding to focus on 1870. Did I hear that correctly?
1570, 1570.
So that's like the first coming of the missionaries, which is kind of interesting because, you know, this year we're celebrating or marking the 500th anniversary of Magellan's arrival.
Yes.
I don't know if it's something that we should be celebrating, but it's...
Our colonization.
Yeah, it's a landmark event. But I can understand why you would need a budget, a bigger budget to do a period film with all the costumes and the sets and all that, as opposed to just setting it in New York City. Jumping ahead to contemporary times, you know... the backdrop, of course, as we discussed, of Lingua Franca was the Trump administration and its anti-immigrant rhetoric, which came up a couple of times in the film, and the crackdown on immigrants. Of course, now you have a brand new president in America. How has it changed for immigrants like you? I know it's still very new, but from what we're reading here, he seems to be moving fast on a number of fronts, no? And culture can change quite fast. I mean, are you feeling any change from where you are as an immigrant, as a Filipino, as a transgender person?
I think, you know, because we're living, you know, in a pandemic and we're not exactly being social, it's hard to experience and really feel these changes in a substantive way in person. And I think for me, just in terms of the micro, subtle, you know, changes of what it's like to live as a Filipina trans immigrant in the US, I would probably feel it in, you know, specific circumstances, like going to the airport, for instance. When it was still Trump and I was invited to Venice, I was really nervous about, you know, flying out of the US and wondering, even though I have a green card, whether I'm going to be questioned when I try to get back into the US. Like, what, you know, why did you travel? Oh, you're a filmmaker. What was your movie about? And telling them that it's about a documented filmmaker trans woman. Like, I don't feel that same worry and concern as I did before. And, you know, I'm eligible to apply for a US citizenship later this year. I don't have to worry about, you know, unexplained delays, for instance. So it's just kind of a feeling of ease and more security about legislative processes that I need to go through, for instance, to complete my pursuit of citizenship, that I don't worry that it's going to be unreasonably difficult or challenging.
Do you want to make films in the Philippines someday?
I'm going to have to with Tropical Gothic. You know, it's set in the Philippines. I'm shooting it in Cebu, where I shot my first movie. Yeah, it really depends on where the ideas that I come up for my next features. But, you know, I think part of the reason why I decided not to shoot Lingua Franca in the Philippines or just set a story there was because, you know, piracy was just so rampant when Aparicion came out. We were out in theaters and just a few days later, you'd have all these pirated DVDs out in the streets. And, you know, we don't really have a dedicated infrastructure to distribute art house and independent films in the Philippines. And, you know, as a market, it's just not attractive to me. Like, I cannot have a livelihood or make a living like that. And that's why I thought the smart decision was to do Lingua Franca in the US and kind of expand my market, so to speak. That is, you know, shooting the film in English, you know, was part of that decision as well. And I'm just glad to see that my gamble has paid off to a certain extent.
Well, related to that, you just mentioned that you're planning to shoot Tropical Gothic in Cebu.
Mm-hmm.
So why Cebu? I mean, if it's a period film, you could actually shoot that almost anywhere, right? Unless some specific Cebu landmarks that you need to put in there.
Yeah, I mean, we're considering other places like Hawaii as well and Puerto Rico, which are also, you know, used to be like Spanish. So they would have the same kind of architecture as, you know, colonial Philippines. I guess I'm choosing to shoot in Cebu for now. You know, that's the plan for sentimental reasons. I was born and raised there, and it feels right to shoot a story about colonial Philippines in the Philippines, at least to me. And even if we're shooting there, that doesn't mean that our market is necessarily just limited to the Filipino market. You know, it's still very much an international co-production and going to be an international release. And part of why I'm partnering with European co-producers is they want it to premiere at, you know, either Cannes or Venice or Berlin. And it's already won a co-production prize in Berlin a few weeks ago.
So is there a formula, I mean, for success in the U.S. movie industry? I mean, what was your path to achieving the kind of success you've had so far?
For me, and, you know, for the longest time, I thought this was very new agey, but it's really being true to yourself. And that means as an artist, what makes you different? What makes you singular? You know, what makes you unique? I didn't shy away from it. I embraced it. And, you know, that's what I wanted to really showcase in my work. I think being in an industry that's risk averse, we are taught to conform and to kind of appeal to the lowest common denominator. But, you know, I thought of myself, I am an independent filmmaker that wants to really make a mark, you know, in the international scene. I can't just do what everyone else is doing. And we shouldn't do that. And that's why, like, Lingua Franca was kind of me breaking away from the formula, because there's a formula that would have, like, a film that would be more neo-social realist or neorealistic, which is like a Broca or Brillante Mendoza, which I think is the primary mode that a lot of independent Filipino independent films or the ones that get programmed abroad have tended to have, you know. But I wanted to do something different. It was a risk, of course, because you don't know what you know, festival programmers are going to respond to. But I think because they realized and they saw that what I was doing was in fact different, that I had a place in the world of, you know, filmmaking, primarily because of that. And because I was an only child, I think, and my mom really encouraged me to be who I am, like, I really celebrated my otherness, so to speak. Because of that, I became fearless and just bold to do what I wanted to do as an artist and as a storyteller. And that's what we should all do. You know, we can't keep doing like the horror by the Thai or the Japanese horror just because we're considered Asian filmmakers or Asian cinema.
You said that, you know, you have to be true to yourself and, you know, in terms of your otherness, no? Obviously, you're a unique person and people like you occupy kind of an unusual or uncommon position in society. But that's often cited as an obstacle. And that's why, you know, there are charges of discrimination against people of color in many industries in the United States, especially show business. Hollywood, you know, there's this whole question of the Oscars being underrepresented in terms of people of color, et cetera, et cetera. But you just said that you can actually turn that to your advantage. And that's one way of penetrating the market. That's one way of acquiring a mass appeal.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I would like to think that Lingua Franca is a pretty decent case study of that. And it's because, you know, these attributes that we're supposed to marginalize us, you know, or make us invisible and delegitimize us. Like for me, I didn't buy into that. And that's why I never thought my point of view was inferior or mediocre. You know, every legendary artist or considered a unique artist just had the confidence and the boldness to kind of do their art their own way. And I think that's what seduces audiences and lovers of art, you know, this unique and original artist doing their own thing. And that's, I think, what people resonate to in my work. You know, they can see that there's a really different voice, you know, just in the way I frame shots or I tell a story. And that's what I'd like to think drew them to my work. And I hope that more filmmakers, you know, not just Filipino, for instance, but those who are emerging, instead of feeling the need to conform and do what everyone else is doing, is to try something new. And even though it's risky, you know, creativity and artistic freedom, it's not going to cost you, especially if you're just starting out. But the upside and the benefit, you know, to you as an artist can be very high.
Which filmmakers and artists have had the most influence on you?
Oh my God. You know, the masters of 70s and 80s Philippine cinema, Ishmael Bernal, Marilu Diaz-Abaya, I love Moral, Broca, of course, and Mike De Leon, I think. I love Kisap Mata, for instance. I just his versatility as a filmmaker, that he's able to do different genres. I mean, I'm not necessarily looking to do that in my own work, but I just am enthralled of how he's able to, you know, navigate these different genres. But for me, kind of my favorite Philippine auteur is Bernal, I think. There's just this intellectual sophistication to his work. Nunal Sa Tubig, for instance, Himala, of course. The Vilma, Christopher De Leon dramas, Relacion and Broken Marriage are two of my favorites ever.
Well, there's a reason why, you know, that period is called the golden age of Philippine cinema, right? Primarily because of the filmmakers you mentioned. But what do you think of contemporary cinema in the Philippines? I don't know how much of it you're able to see in America, but you did mention at least a couple, Brillante, Mendoza, and, well, you mentioned Broca, but Broca's been long gone, right? But there are several others that have been competing.
La Diaz, of course, you know.
Yes, of course, yeah. He lives in New York as well.
Yes.
Yeah. So anyway, what do you think of contemporary Philippine cinema?
I think it's very vibrant. You know, in 2005, when Cinemalaya entered the scene, it really marked the emergence of a digital, you know, filmmaking school, I think, and just because of how it's made resources to make movies more accessible to a lot more filmmakers, there's just been explosion of really exciting, bold work. I remember there was also Encuentro by Pepe Diokno. We have Adolfo Alex. So personally, to be honest, I am very, very, and I watch a just limited amount of movies. Sometimes they're the more obscure and the esoteric ones that have inspired me. But I would love to hopefully see more art house Philippine films being distributed in North America, for sure, and becoming more accessible to Filipino-American audiences here, you know, and not just in the Philippines.
What do you miss about the Philippines?
You know, it's such a bittersweet. I feel like I have an ambivalent relationship with the Philippines because the last time I was there, this was October 28, 2019, just a month after Venice. And that was the first time I went back home in 6 years since I transitioned. And, you know, in the U.S., in New York, whenever I go out of the house, I never, ever felt conscious about, like, being trans or anything like that. But when I landed at NAIA, and that was just 3 months after this big, you know, news about this transgender woman getting dragged out of the women's bathroom by this female security guard. I don't know, like when I was at NAIA and I was walking to the women's bathroom, like I felt self-conscious and I felt, you know, paranoid. And it's just unfortunate because I should not feel that way about my home country, you know? If there's one place I should feel safe to be who I am and to, you know, to just be and exist, it should be the Philippines. But I feel that way in the U.S., and that's such a complicated feeling to have, you know. But of course, you know, that's where I grew up. I still continue to make films about not just my experience as a Filipino, but our collective history, you know, as a country. My next movie is about Spanish colonialism in the Philippines, after all. So, you know, people are interesting, confusing creatures. And about, you know, sometimes I can't really tell what internal forces motivate me, but I still find myself drawn to telling stories about our country.
Well, you did say that you're planning to shoot your next film in the Philippines. Did you say early 2022, did you say?
2022, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So your growing audience and your fans will be able to see you in Cebu and hopefully yeah. we'll watch your film here in the Philippines. We want to
yes.
thank you. Yeah, we want to thank you for all you're doing in raising consciousness, entertaining us, making us wiser about the world, and making us proud as Filipinos and as Filipino fans of movies. Maraming maraming salamat, Isabel Sandoval.
Maraming salamat din po, Mr. Severino. And you know, it's such an honor. I know all about you, of course. You're an icon.
Thank you. Thank you.
In Philippine media. And it's, you know, it's truly an honor and a delight to be speaking with you.
Yes, thank you. And we know you've stayed up for us, and we really appreciate your time. Isabel Sandoval, Filipina auteur. Mm. Good luck on your career. Be safe. Ingat.
Thank you for having me. Thank you. Thank you, Pop.
This story was produced by the team of Meg Pamiloza and Shai Lagarde, with the wonderful people of GMA News and Public Affairs Digital and GMA Post Production. Don't forget to like and subscribe. Maraming salamat po, and be safe. Till the next pod, bye-bye.